Well, good afternoon. I hate being the last one up. Hopefully, we won't lose the audience too badly, but, and hopefully I won't be stepping on the toes of the rheumatologists in too much of a fashion. But I was tasked with giving another topic that is not necessarily that of a nephrologist, but uric acid is a poison, and I thought I would talk about the evils that uric acid can cause. Now, we as physicians order a lot of lab tests, and many of the lab tests are non-routine, including vitamin D levels, uric acid levels, phosphorus, magnesium, and PSAs. I did a search over at the hospitals as to which one of these tests is the most common, and vitamin D is probably the most common non-routine lab study that's ordered. And many patients are treated with vitamin D for low vitamin D levels. However, the studies showing that the benefits of vitamin D treatment are fairly marginal, and there are not a whole lot of studies showing benefits for vitamin D therapy other than for bone disease. There are putative benefits for cancer prevention, cardiac prevention, and many other disorders, but none have really been proven as of yet. What I'm going to speak about is uric acid, and make the case that uric acid should be a more routine test that we do in our patients, and that possibly treating hyperuricemia may benefit a majority of our patients. So uric acid is an end product of purine metabolism, and it's mostly in the liver. It's not typically ingested. The ingestion of uric acid contributes almost nothing to our total body uric acid, but the diet does provide a number of precursors of uric acid. And you'll see in a few minutes that fructose is one of the major culprits there. And hyperuricemia occurs in over 20% of the adult population. The excretion of uric acid is mostly by the kidneys with some contribution of the GI tract. You can see in this slide that the purines are the major source of uric acid production. And unfortunately, in our development, we lost uric acid oxidase, urate oxidase. This is an enzyme that's present in some mammals and in other species that converts uric acid to allantoin. Allantoin is a benign compound, whereas uric acid is not. And in our development, we lost urate oxidase, and so we make uric acid, and that's an end product. And it has to be excreted, mostly by the kidneys, and again, some by the GI tract. And that's where the problem starts in terms of the complications related to uric acid. So there are a number of disorders of uric acid metabolism, and I'll go through each of these in a little bit of detail. First is that of asymptomatic hyperuricemia. There's no universally accepted definition, but in general, blood levels greater than 6 to 8 milligrams per deciliter are considered hyperuricemia. And these can be due to either excess production or decreased excretion. Fortunately, less than a third of patients who have hyperuricemia will develop gout, tophi, kidney stones, or urate nephropathy. So we're lucky that most of us will have hyperuricemia, or many of us will have hyperuricemia, but not really develop these complications. If the uric acid level is greater than 8, however, these patients do need some evaluation because they are at increased risk for developing complications. Now, causes of hyperuricemia due to increased production. You can see in this slide there are a number of different causes, and I'll just point out a couple of them that are of interest, including myeloproliferative disorders, glycogen storage diseases, ethanol, especially beer, vitamin B12 deficiency, fructose, and excess purine ingestion. So that increased production is due to a number of these factors, and we can affect these by dietary and lifestyle changes. You can see that obesity is also one of the factors in hyperuricemia, and again, this is a correctable factor in patients who develop hyperuricemia. It's interesting, fructose intake and high fructose intake is a major culprit in the development of hyperuricemia because, number one, of ATP to AMP conversion, which results in increased purine catabolism. In addition, this results in increased lactate production, which interferes with uric acid excretion by the kidneys. So that the people who are drinking lots of sodas with high fructose, the corn syrups that have high fructose, they're at higher risk for developing hyperuricemia. There are also causes of decreased renal clearance, and you can look at this list as well. Chronic kidney disease with decreased glomerular filtration is obviously one of the causes. Volume depletion is another cause of decreased urinary clearance. Significant cause is that of obesity again. The use of diuretics, and thiazide diuretics are the biggest culprits in terms of decreased renal clearance of uric acid. So that if you have a patient with hyperuricemia, using a thiazide diuretic for whatever purpose may actually worsen the hyperuricemia that these patients are developing. Low-dose salicylates are another possible cause because they interfere with urinary clearance, and you can see the rest of this list, which I will not go into in much detail. Beer is probably one of the bigger culprits. So how do we manage asymptomatic hyperuricemia? Well, non-pharmacologic measures are obviously important in terms of alcohol restriction, especially beer. Diet, restricting purines and restricting high fructose ingestion, and weight loss. The medications that can induce hyperuricemia should also be avoided, especially the thiazide diuretics, as I mentioned above. ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. Losartan is one of the ARBs that actually causes increased uric acid excretion by the kidneys. So if patients need treatment for hypertension and they have hyperuricemia, losartan may be a good choice. The other ARBs have been studied, but losartan is the only ARB that has been shown to have this benefit. When do we recommend urate-lowering therapy? By drug therapy, when the serum urate is above 13 in men and above 10 in women, and when they have marked elevation of the urinary uric acid over 1,000 or 1,100 milligrams per 24 hours. These patients are at increased risk for developing uric acid stones as well as possible uric acid nephropathy. Unfortunately, this means that these patients have to be on lifelong therapy, and it's unclear whether they are truly benefited by this form of treatment. So let's talk about gout. This was how gout presented in 1799. It's actually the oldest form of arthritis. It was first identified almost 5,000 years ago. Hippocrates referred to it as arthritis of the rich because they drank a lot of alcohol, had a lot of high purine foods, whereas the poorer people could not afford this. So the rich people back then were the ones who developed gout. The tophi were first described by Galen. And actually, the word gout comes from the Latin word gutta, which means drop. And it was first mentioned in the 13th century. And one of the four humors, evil humors, would fall into the foot and caused gout. So it dropped into the foot and caused gout. So you can see a list of famous sufferers. I mean, there's a huge list of popes, presidents, famous politicians, historical figures who had gout, including Benjamin Franklin. And this is the classic description of a gout flare. You go to bed, you're in good health, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, you're awakened by severe pain in the big toe, more rarely in the heel, ankle, or instep. The parts feel as if cold water were poured over them. It is a violent stretching and tearing. It is gnawing pain. It's a pressure that you cannot even bear the weight of bedclothes on your toe. The night is spent in torture. And this was over 400 years ago. Gout is the most common form of inflammatory arthritis. It's much more common than chronic back pain, fibromyalgia, carpal tunnel syndrome, or rheumatoid arthritis. You can see that in the US, about 8 million people are affected by gout. This is both arthritic gout as well as tophaceous gout. And it's characterized by recurrent attacks of acute inflammatory arthritis, characterized by elevated uric acid levels in the blood. The uric acid crystallizes and deposits in the joints and tendons. Hyperuricemia does not necessarily mean gout. Gout is a diagnosis of the joint or of the tophaceous deposit, and hyperuricemia does not necessarily mean gout. You can see that gout affects men more than women, and as we get older, it's more common, and it's more common the higher the level of uric acid. Now, why does the big toe suffer from gout more commonly than any of the other joints? Because it's one of our coldest joints. And for some reason, the uric acid has decreased solubility in a colder environment. And the big toe is our coldest extremity. And therefore, that's the theory. And actually, the big toe is the most commonly affected joint. And what happens in an acute gout attack? The crystals are phagocytized by the cells in the joint and by the monocytes. They release a whole bunch of inflammatory products, and you develop the gouty attack. And who are the patients that develop this? Patients who are males with an advanced age, postmenopausal women, and patients who have comorbidities including hypertension, cardiovascular disease, chronic kidney disease, hyperlipidemia, and metabolic syndrome. There's some data that these are interrelated, that actually hyperuricemia may be a player in the development of metabolic syndrome as well. So there's an interrelationship between gout, hyperuricemia, and the metabolic syndrome. We already talked about obesity as being a lifestyle problem associated with hyperuricemia and gout. Diet that's rich in meat and seafood. Patients who have increased alcohol intake, as well as high fructose corn syrup. Whoops. You can see also that obesity plays a major role. As your BMI goes up, your risk for gout goes up. So a patient with a BMI of 40 has an almost 5 times as high risk of developing gout as a person whose BMI is within the, quote, normal level. So gout flares occur when the crystals trigger an acute inflammatory response in the joint. The flares may be triggered by fluctuations in uric acid levels. Even sometimes the uric acid level can go down, and even then the patient may develop a gouty attack because the uric acid level went down and the level fluctuated. Phagocytosis of the uric acid crystals induces a pro-inflammatory response, and there you go, getting the gout flare. The way to diagnose gout is by drawing joint fluid and looking for crystals. That's the definitive diagnosis. Most of the patients that we see are diagnosed with a hot swollen joint and an elevated uric acid, and joint arthrocentesis, especially in the acute setting, is not done as often as it should be. So that the diagnosis is presumptively made based on uric acid level and joint involvement, but the real diagnosis is made by joint aspiration, looking for the crystals. So this is gout in the finger. These are tophi in the hand. And they're frequently seen in the ear over the electron process on the Achilles tendon and in multiple other areas, as you can see on this slide. Rarely it occurs in the eyes, on the heart or the colon. So the American College of Rheumatology made some recommendations a few years ago regarding treatment of gout. For acute flares, treat with pharmacological therapy, either nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, corticosteroids, or colchicine as soon as possible. Prophylaxis is with one of these agents, and long-term treatment with a hypouricemic agent, and I'll get to these in a few minutes. And chronic gout management involves long-term treatment with hypouricemic agents, as well as monitoring of the blood levels. After the patient is stabilized, they should have at least uric acid level done every 6 months while they're being treated chronically. So the hallmark for acute treatment are either NSAIDs, corticosteroids, or colchicine. The most common NSAID that's been used in the past is indomethacin. Unfortunately, it has lots of gastrointestinal and kidney toxicity, and you can use any of the NSAIDs. The really contraindication for NSAIDs is patients with chronic kidney disease because you might make their kidney function worse. Don't use aspirin again because it competes with uric acid for excretion by the kidneys, and you may actually make hyperuricemia worse. Corticosteroids can be used for treatment of acute gout, and these may be used in patients who have contraindications for the nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, especially patients who have chronic kidney disease or who have a history of peptic ulcer disease. And you can see some of the other reasons to not use nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Finally, we get to colchicine. IV colchicine is no longer available. The standard has been to use relatively high doses of colchicine early on. Unfortunately, this was associated with significant gastrointestinal toxicity. In addition, colchicine has become very expensive once the patent was changed, so that acute high-dose colchicine may be problematic, both in terms of complications and in terms of expense. And this study was published recently and looked at high dose versus low dose colchicine, and there's really no difference in terms of resolution of the gout flare, so that a relatively low dose of colchicine, maybe 1.8 milligrams over 24 hours, should be sufficient in these patients without a significant problem with side effects. Colchicine does have side effects, including gastrointestinal. Hopefully, we don't see overdoses from colchicine, but it can cause bone marrow depression. And in severe overdoses, it can also cause cardiac arrhythmias. So the treatment for gout and tophaceous gout involves acute treatment for pain management, for anti-inflammatory management with either nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or COX-2 agents, colchicine, or corticosteroids. This is a treatment for the acute attack. The chronic treatment involves hypouricemic treatment. You should never treat patients with hypouricemic agents during an acute attack because you can actually make the attack worse. And you should never start these on their own without protecting the patient with colchicine or one of the other anti-inflammatory drugs. So the FDA-approved urate-lowering agents include allopurinol and febuxostat. These are xanthine oxidase inhibitors. You can see the dosage there. Allopurinol has been around for many, many years. Febuxostat is relatively new and is a second-line drug after allopurinol in the majority of patients. You can use uricosuric drugs, and for severe treatment refractory disease, you can use pegloticase, which is uricase given intravenously. The major problem with pegloticase is its severely high cost. So for the approved urate-lowering agents, allopurinol is number one, febuxostat is number two, and then between probenecid and pegloticase, I think pegloticase may be the drug of choice in patients who are refractory or cannot be controlled on allopurinol or febuxostat. Unfortunately, allopurinol does have a number of drug-drug interactions. You can see the list there. There's a number of drug-drug interactions, including warfarin, Dilantin, and a few of the immunosuppressive drugs, so that in these patients, you'd have to be very careful in treating them with allopurinol. There is the allopurinol hypersensitivity syndrome, which is a severe drug reaction with skin rash and eosinophilia. This happens relatively uncommonly. And obviously, discontinuation of the drug and switching to an alternative agent is indicated. Febuxostat and allopurinol work in the same way. They inhibit xanthine oxidase. It's not recommended for the treatment of asymptomatic hyperuricemia. It can reduce the elevated serum uric acid levels. But if you look at its comparison with allopurinol, the side effects and adverse reactions are relatively similar. The only difference is a higher incidence of rash with allopurinol versus febuxostat, so that, again, the treatment for chronic hyperuricemia and hypouricemic therapy should be allopurinol as the first drug of choice, with febuxostat being your second line if the allopurinol is ineffective or if the patient develops a complication. This looks at pegloticase, which is, again, the intravenous form of the drug that breaks down allopurinol, uric acid, I'm sorry. Again, giving this every 2 weeks intravenously brings down the blood levels significantly. This is your third line drug after allopurinol and febuxostat. Unfortunately, the expense of this drug is the major side effect. It also does cause a number of reactions. It can cause muscle spasm and stiffness, significant nausea and flushing. But I think the cost of the drug is really the major detriment. So the strategy for lowering uric acid is you initiate prophylaxis with low-dose colchicine prior to initiating urate-lowering drugs. You initiate a uricostatic agent at a low dose and gradually escalate the dose, with your target uric acid level being below 6. It's recommended to continue the anti-inflammatory prophylaxis for 3 to 6 months while the patient is being treated with either allopurinol or febuxostat to prevent an acute gouty attack. And you maintain the agent pretty much indefinitely. Check uric acid levels once or twice yearly. There's no evidence of cross-reactivity between allopurinol and febuxostat, so that if allopurinol does cause you problems, switching to febuxostat is a reasonable option. And you can see here that as the uric acid level is brought down to less than 6, the risk of future gout attacks is markedly decreased, and the current recommendations are a blood level of uric acid below 6 to treat patients with chronic gout or tophi. You'll be seeing in the literature in the future newer therapies that are coming out for treatment of gout. These include urate lowering therapies as well as anti-inflammatory therapies. These are still in the experimental testing phases, but you'll be seeing these drugs mentioned in the literature in the coming years. So going on from gout to uric acid kidney stones. The most common kidney stones are calcium kidney stones, and these are calcium oxalate, which are the most common, and calcium phosphate as well. Uric acid stones account for between 10 and 15% of all kidney stones, whereas calcium kidney stones are approximately 60 or 70% of all kidney stones. There are other less common kidney stones, including struvite stones in patients who have chronic urinary retention and chronic urinary tract infections, and rarely cystine stones. So uric acid precipitates in the acidic urine, so that the risk factors for developing uric acid kidney stones are hyperuricosuria. So patients who have increased uric acid excretion in the urine are at increased risk for developing uric acid stones. So that 10 to 20% of patients with gout overproduce uric acid, and they excrete it by the kidneys, and they have hyperuricosuria. They can also have inherited defects of uric acid production. And the risk factors, other than hyperuricosuria, include an acid urine. So that patients who have an acid urine are at increased risk for developing uric acid stones as well. So that patients who have chronic diarrhea, who lose bicarbonate through the GI tract, who develop acidic concentrated urine, are also at risk for developing uric acid stones. And the medical management is either allopurinol or febuxostat, depending on the tolerance of the patients to these drugs, urinary alkalization, low purine diet, and a high fluid intake. Now, if they have hypercalciuria, that poses a problem because hypercalciuria, the calcium can precipitate in an alkaline urine. So alkalinizing the urine in patients who have hypercalciuria may not be the best idea. But in patients who are pure uric acid kidney stone formers, acidifying the urine and treating them with one of the uricostatic drugs is really the treatment for these patients. Okay, tumor lysis syndrome. This is a potentially fatal metabolic complication that occurs in some patients, mostly with cancer. It involves a complex series of events where the cancer chemotherapy results in cell kill, and the cells release their intracellular contents, including uric acid. And the kidneys are responsible for excreting the uric acid. Usually occurs within 24 to 48 hours after chemotherapy and may persist for days or weeks. And it may occur as early as 6 hours after chemotherapy. And the most common tumor types are listed here. These include non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, acute leukemia, chronic lymphoblastic leukemia, and a small number of solid tumors. So these patients will have a big tumor kill. Many of them have markedly elevated white blood counts. They're given chemotherapy, the cells die, and the cells release their intracellular contents, uric acid being one of them, potassium, phosphorus, and these patients can develop uric acid crystallization within the kidneys and acute renal failure due to tumor lysis syndrome. So these patients will develop hyperuricemia, and they can develop uric acid levels greater than 20 milligrams per deciliter. They very frequently will have hyperkalemia, hyperphosphatemia, and hypocalcemia. So this is pretty much the diagnostic findings in these patients with tumor lysis syndrome. And the treatment is prevention, really. These patients should be, first of all, identified as to who's at risk, and the oncologists are really onto this. They pre-treat the patients pretty aggressively. They pre-treat them with either allopurinol, and they alkalize the urine. So that a patient who has lymphoma or high tumor burden who's going to receive chemotherapy, pre-treatment is very important in these patients with allopurinol and with aggressive hydration with sodium bicarbonate. They can also be treated with rasburicase, which is urate oxidase. Remember I mentioned at the beginning that we don't have urate oxidase. Rasburicase will break down uric acid into allantoin, which is a benign compound. And these patients can be treated with rasburicase, which again reduces the uric acid pool and reduces blood uric acid levels. It does not require alkalization. Whoops. And has really been a major development in the treatment and prevention of uric acid tumor lysis syndrome. There's an entity called chronic urate nephropathy. Uric acid can affect the kidneys by causing vascular problems within the kidney, by causing a pro-inflammatory state, by causing vascular disease. And this is a study that was recently published in our nephrology journals that looked at treating patients with hyperuricemia and chronic kidney disease whose baseline GFR was about 31 or 32. These patients with hyperuricemia were placed on febuxostat or placebo, and you can see that the patients, after 6 months, the placebo patients had a significant decline in kidney function, whereas the patients who were treated with febuxostat with treatment of the hyperuricemia had a much better outcome, and their kidney function was well preserved. So that there's some data that chronic urate nephropathy may have some benefits by treatment with urate-lowering therapy. Finally, there are some proposed complications of uric acid. These include the metabolic syndrome, diabetic complications, and cardiovascular disease. Framingham's study looked at this, and higher levels of serum uric acid were associated with an increased future risk of developing type 2 diabetes, independent of other risk factors. So that they postulated that serum uric acid may, elevated levels may play a role in identifying individuals who are at risk for type 2 diabetes. So does that mean that everybody with hyperuricemia should be treated? I'm not sure the answer is in yet, but at least it's intriguing and worth more investigation. I will stop there now, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them for you. The question was, probenecid is not indicated for the treatment of hyperuricemia. That is not completely true. In patients who you cannot control with uricostatic agents, probenecid may be of benefit. The problem with probenecid is that you need relatively normal kidney function because it's going to be a uricosuric drug, and you need relatively normal kidney function. Also, if they're at risk for kidney stones or have are at risk for chronic kidney disease, then probenecid may not be a good idea either. So that it's a third line drug after allopurinol and febuxostat for treatment of hyperuricemia. But it's really not used very much now because allopurinol and febuxostat are in general pretty effective. Yes?
Harry, I've got two for you. You want them together or separate?
Go for it.
All right, number one, what are the pros and cons on allopurinol if you're titrating versus just starting at 300 milligrams? I've often found that most need 300, and I go to that. Is there a drawback to starting at 300 and then going down, or why not start at 100? Why not start at 300 instead of going 100 and then slowly going up? Second, do we have any outcome studies in the process or plan showing that treating asymptomatic hyperuricemia has any positive outcome?
First of all, I think 300 is reasonable to start with as long as their kidney function is normal and they're not having acute attacks. I think that's relatively reasonable to start with. I'm not aware of any actual studies that are being undertaken to treat asymptomatic hyperuricemia, especially in the mildly elevated range. I mean, if the uric acid level is above 10 or 14, then I think you might want to put those patients on treatment, although the data is still not completely clear that that's going to be a benefit. Other questions? Well, thank you for your attention, and have a good evening.